you can find whatever it might be, a few thousandth in your latest bit of code or setup or whatever it might be. But if that driver's had a bad day the day before, or he's had a cold, or he's something's upset him, you can lose a lot more than that. And so their head game is massive.
Hello and welcome to the James Allen on F1 podcast, brought to you by Autosport. Now, this week, we're going to look into the curious case of Daniel Ricciardo. He will not be lining up in Austin or any other Grand Prix after being dropped in one of those kind of worst kept secrets episodes that F1 does just so very chillingly. Daniel was one of Formula One's biggest fan favourites and an 8-time Grand Prix winner, but he's not been the same driver for a few years now. As always with F1, a sport which is all about technology and hardware, at the heart of all of this is a very human story. So we thought we would drill down into that story. What made Ricciardo special and what went wrong? We're going to hear from a chief engineer whose job was to prepare Ricciardo for his big time 2014 move to Red Bull Racing, and from the Australian F1 TV host who's known him since the early days. With me in the studio to fill in the picture are two top F1 journalists who cover Ricciardo's entire career. Autosport's F1 editor, John Noble. Welcome, John.
Hi, James. Good to have me on again. Thank you.
Always a pleasure to see you, John. Busy as always. And chief motorsport writer, Ben Hunt. Great to see you too, Ben.
Thanks, James. Yeah, thanks.
John, listen, set the scene for us. Ricciardo looked to me a haunted figure in Singapore. Everybody was going around saying that RB was going to replace him with Liam Lawson. What was going on behind the scenes?
Yeah, I think there were kind of two parallel kind of truths going on at the time. There was the public situation. So we were portrayed that, you know, the rumors were that Lawson was coming in, almost kind of accepted by everyone. Lawson was coming in and Ricciardo was out. But there'd be no official confirmation of it. Daniel on Thursday had kind of been careful with his words, saying it's not, you know, he's not going to bet his house that it's not happening, but he hadn't been informed and was pushing on and hoping just to, I think in his words, kick some ass that weekend to kind of keep the seat. And then that's how things played out. Then on Saturday, I think, you know, Friday was a solid performance from the team. It looked pretty good. Saturday's knocked out in Q1. I spoke to him in the pen and completely deflated. I think he knew then it was finished. And then Sunday we went through the process of the race, you know, the farewell fastest lap, the kind of guard of honor when he came back into the RB motome after the race, saying goodbye to people in the paddock. So that was all taking place, which led to kind of this perception that Red Bull had done the dirty on Ricciardo, that he hadn't been told of what was happening, that it all came out of the blue and that suddenly he was out and there wasn't a chance to wave goodbye. But that wasn't actually the reality. I've spoken to, you know, some people who knew what was going on. I think Ricciardo was, you know, pretty well knew the writing had been on the wall quite earlier in the season. Even Spanish Grand Prix, Helmut Marko was trying to push him out. From what I understand, he was informed before the Baku Grand Prix and then on the weekend of the Baku Grand Prix that Singapore would be his last race, that they needed to bring Liam Lawson in just to understand his potential, his capabilities amid the uncertainty over Sergio Perez's performances. So Daniel knew from Baku that this was going to be his final race. I understand there was a conversation took place with the Ricciardo camp about, do you want to make it official? Do we want to do an announcement, go public, that this will be your final race and you can say the goodbyes? That didn't go anywhere. They didn't want that to happen. So that's how it played out. And I think that one of the kind of things, would be nice to speak to Daniel one day about why things played out that way. It's just why he didn't want to do that retirement. My personal feeling is that, you know, he's the honey badger. He's the fighter. He's someone who's been determined to make everything. And I think he believed, and I think this was reiterated in conversations I understand he had with Red Bull chiefs, that if he finishes on the podium in Singapore, if he wins the Singapore Grand Prix, that seat's still his. They surely couldn't have got rid of him if he finished on the podium. And if he won the race, I think I was told by someone, he asked them, what if I win Singapore? And someone joked, you'd be in the Red Bull car replacing Sergio. So I think there's probably that belief that he didn't want to hang on to the view that this was over. I think he wanted to fight to the final lap to think that, you know, this is my chance to show it. And I think this explains that change in mindset from Friday to Saturday, that when we spoke to the pen, that knocked out in Q1 on Saturday, when it was pretty much over, was why suddenly he was down and deflated and, you know, biting his tongue not to say what he really felt.
Ben, you were there in Singapore too. You watched Daniel closely throughout that weekend. What were your observations of how he was living the experience?
For me, the biggest thing was the change. The Thursday Daniel was very different to the Sunday Daniel, and the transformation, you know, the penny dropping, the realization. When I looked at him on Thursday, he was sort of still joking and laughing. The smile was still there, you know, that we've come to appreciate and love over all these years. And, you know, he's a figure that's sort of been caught up in this drive to survive generation, you know, very front and center. Someone that, you know, that the young viewers can relate to, and, you know, a great figure. But then what we saw on Sunday, and I followed him through the paddock. It was unusual because he was wearing like a vest, and you don't often see drivers without at least a t-shirt on. But he was walking through with a vest. He had his drinks bottle. And just taking his time just to walk through and, you know, just soak it all up. And I agree with John. I mean, I do believe that, you know, he was holding on to the hope that, you know, had he done a good performance in Singapore, then he would have been assured that he was at least staying on till the end of the year, live to fight another day. And that's what I assumed that he was basing everything on. And it was that realization walking through the paddock that this was it. This was the last chance. And I understand that he's not in Austin, which is a shame because obviously he, you know, is popular in the US. And, you know, I think back, you know, to the times and the accents and, you know, really embracing the college football team there and everything he's done. He will be missed coming into this US Grand Prix. And it's a shame because I always like characters and we are now down a character, a very big one.
We are indeed. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. But let's bring in our first guest. In 2012 and 2013, Red Bull was looking for the next Sebastian Vettel, a driver who could win them world championships. Phil Charles was working at Toro Rosso as chief race engineer at the time. And for the 2014 season, one driver was going to get Mark Webber's Red Bull Racing seat alongside Vettel. It was the job of Phil and his team to give Ricciardo and his teammate Jean-Éric Vergne the platform to shine in a winner-takes-all battle for the F1 big time. Well, Phil is now deputy team principal of DS Penske Formula E team, and I went to his Space Age base near Oxford to have a chat with him. So, Phil, thank you, first of all, for coming on the podcast. Great to see you.
Great to be here with you. Absolutely great to be with you.
You had a really close look at Daniel Ricciardo when you were working together for 2 years at Toro Rosso in the early 2010s, where you were the chief race engineer. What were his qualities as a racing driver at the time?
Yeah, so a great time. We had an amazing group of young drivers there, as you remember, I'm sure. We had Jean-Éric and Jean-Éric Vergne and Daniel in the two cars, and you're two very different characters. Daniel, I would say, was a super lovable, cheeky chappy. I think you see him over the years with that big grin on his face. He always had that there, but actually it kind of hid a steely determination. He would be very motivating around the guys, around the engineers, but he always did it with a smile on his face. So you always felt he was really making you like him, but he was asking you to get the next thing out of the car. And that was a really big asset for him. He was a real intelligent driver, super, super guy to be around. But underneath, it wasn't just a jokey guy or a fun guy. There was a steely kind of desire to make the next step, much like we had with Jean-Éric. The two of them were absolutely fierce competitors, but very different characters. And Dan was the likable, lovable chap out of the car. That was his real asset.
Daniel was a little bit older than Jean-Éric at the time. I mean, they were quite closely matched on performance, as I recall. Mm-hmm. Daniel, I think, was probably the stronger race driver at that time, which may have been a reflection of maturity as well. But how did you see him develop during those years?
I think if you compare the two, actually, Jev, they're very different drivers and very different characters outside of the car. And that's the big distinction. Jev had the massive natural talent. And perhaps, like you say, Daniel was a little bit more mature. He used his people skills to the absolute maximum. So he was the best one out of the car. And he took that approach out of the car, into the car. I know that sounds a little bit obvious, but by working the engineers around him really, really well, it was always great to be with on the simulator, always great to have a chat about, in-depth chat about the car out of the car. He would then make himself faster as he went into the weekend. But probably one of the biggest things I remember about him was just how intelligent the approach was. So you talk about maturity. but he had a really very detailed approach to his race weekends. So quite often he would be able to tell you, when I go into qualifying, I get new tyres, I'll break 5 metres later for that corner, 2 metres for that corner, 6 metres for that one. And then each run, I'll try another 2 metres there. Everything was evolved. Everything was really well thought out. You know, you think about his big overtakes he did over the years. He used to practice going offline in the early sessions in the weekend. It wasn't by accident. Everything had a really detailed, understood approach to the way to go racing. And that was maybe the difference. John Erik was big talent, relied on his talent. Daniel really was a thinker and an intelligent driver.
Did he have any particular skills that you know? I mean, you've worked with so many great drivers over your long career. I mean, did he have any particular, was he better on the brakes? Was he just a little bit more responsive on the steering, or was it throttle control? Was there any specifics that you would point to that made Daniel Ricciardo special?
So his super talent was he was pretty good at all of it, all of that, all of everything that you go driving with. He was a strong braker, but he was a real disciple or a real professor of the game. So his superpower was that he was intelligently going into all the avenues of driving a race car. Again, it's easy to make the comparisons. Jev has a really good inertial sensor in the middle of him. When the conditions change, he reacts very quickly to the conditions. The natural talent is bubbling out of him. Daniel hadn't maybe got all of that natural talent, but he thought about how to do every part of driving. So he invested in himself in every direction. And so when you get into the car, he always had done his homework. He'd always really understood what he needed to get out of the car. And he always went into the weekend with a really good approach. So that was his superhero powers. Big brain.
So big brain, yeah. Mm. So,
and a big smile. Big,
and a
big
smile, fantastic big smile. He certainly yeah. still got that. Although when I first encountered him in the HRT days, he had braces on his teeth.
Yeah.
And I used to have to go and interview him for TV. And the first thing he would do would ask the comms person to hold up a little mirror so he could see if he had any spaghetti or bits of broccoli in his braces.
Yeah, well, that's a good story. That is a good story.
But anyway, so your job there, obviously, as the chief race engineer of Toro Rosso at the time, and obviously today it's been through various different iterations, but it's still basically there to produce the next generation of Red Bull Racing potential champions. And the team had a big success, obviously, producing Sebastian Vettel 5 or 6 years earlier. He'd then gone on to race and win 4 world championships at Red Bull. And so they were looking for the next Vettel. Mm. And in the end, it was Daniel who got that promotion. But first of all, what was it like to be in that environment? You know, what's kind of the mandate when you're developing those young drivers?
Yeah, so it's massive pressure on the drivers. So we had a great crop there. So Jean-Eric and Daniel were the first two. But don't forget what came after that either. Danny Kvyat, Carlos Sainz, and then Max. You know, Max, I think, is a slightly different situation, because the other guys really did come through the Red Bull system. You know, Helmut picked them up at a certain point in their career and made it happen for them. Max gets kind of bought in at a later stage of his development, or even as short as the development was. So you've got these young guys. They are the cream of the cream in talent terms. They've done something up to that point, but now they've got their chance. And if you take Daniel and you take Jean-Eric, both of those guys knew if they didn't make it in this scenario, something else happens. You know, this is my only chance. And if I don't do it, what have I got? They're asking themselves. You know, fortunately, Jean-Eric, and I work with Jean-Eric now, amazing. He went on, had a really good career. But at that point, they're thinking F1 is everything. This is my chance. I've got this guy that's pushed me through. I've got the backing of Red Bull. This is my window. So massive pressure. I think it was the Webber seat that was coming up effectively for these two. So 2012 and 2013, they're racing against each other. Massive pressure. I've got to beat the other one. If I don't beat the other one, what have I got? I might have nothing. And it's a known fact within the Red Bull scenario. You get your chance. We all back you. But if you don't do it on that day at the right time, we'll try the next one. So these guys are under huge, huge pressure. They are young kids. And as you mentioned, I think Jean-Eric and Daniel, different characters, they deal with pressure in a different way. Maybe at the time, Jean-Eric was a little bit of a stronger character, ups and downs, you know, real kind of emotional guy. Daniel was using the psychology outside of the car to his advantage. So he was a little bit more evolved in that scenario. So two guys, two different characters, massive pressure. How do they deal with it? How do they go about it? I was a race engineer to Jean-Eric as well. I came into the chief race engineer role through 2013. So I got to see one of them really up close, and then I got to see the two of them. And wow, real fireworks in a lot of ways. And that rubs off in the engineering group. You know, Toro Rosso at the time, it was very clear, you know, you're not here to win the world championship, you're here to make these next drivers. So everybody's under pressure, the team's under pressure. Try not to benefit one over the other, but make sure you give them every opportunity you can to show their abilities, because these guys are the ones in the next Red Bull seat. So big pressure. I think they both handled it in different ways. they're so young at the time, these guys as well, that they haven't yet worked out how they deal with pressure at that level either. So they're going into it for the first time. Daniel dealt with it very well. I'd say if you look at 2013, the one that really decided, Jean-Eric started the year stronger. Daniel got better. And I'm not saying necessarily results. This is just the general performance that they were delivering as a whole. Because the results sometimes, if you look in short term, mask a lot of what's really going on. You can get a result, get two results, and you can have two DNFs in a row. You might be the stronger driver and have two DNFs, and on the paper, you don't look great. So if you stand back and look at the start of 2013, Jev was really strong. But Daniel showed his work ethic, showed his ability to get the people outside of the car working for him, and he improved through the year and started to put more pressure on Jean-Eric. So amazing escalation of two young, real fantastic talents firing it towards each other to trying to go forward and get that Red Bull seat. So real pressure cooker, and a great time, great drivers, great young drivers, but they're learning, they're evolving, they're kids, you know, in a lot of ways they're still kids and they're trying to race to get to that big thing, that big Red Bull seat.
And the validation of all your work, Phil, was that he then got into the Red Bull car the following year and actually beat Sebastian Vettel, who'd won four world championships on the bounce. Mm. Did that surprise you?
Didn't surprise us at all. In fact, I think in Daniel's case, the maturity, the intelligence was there outside of the car to make that next step. It also doesn't surprise me that later in his career, he's had some slight stutters as he's changed teams. He'd built up around us and he'd grown using all those people skills with the people. And of course, when you're in Toro Rosso, you're using the Red Bull sim. So you're interacting with a lot of the Red Bull people when you go there. He made the stepping stone with the people around him very, very well, kind of placed very well, driven through that process. So it didn't surprise me. He jumped into the Red Bull and delivered. Great talent. You could see the two of them were amazing talents, and he'd engineered the people around him really well. So he made that stepping stone almost look seamless. So, and Sebastian, great driver. He was in a slightly tricky scenario. Daniel was well placed on the ascendancy, understanding the people, understanding the car, understanding the tyre at the time. So yeah, it didn't surprise me. There are then some examples after that. Danny Kvyat, where again, a great talent, probably emotionally and all the psychological aspects outside of the car, he wasn't quite ready for the Red Bull jump. But you could see, contrasting the two, Daniel was, he was ready for the people and he did the people bit well. The driving he can already do, he was ready for the people. Some of the other youngsters that kind of came through, still evolving the people side, the human side.
It's fascinating, isn't it, to look at it? I mean, you've been part of it, you know from the inside, but it's still going on today, you know. Mm. They've still got these drivers now. They've got Tsunoda. They're going to put, you know, Lawson in there and see if he can make it. But they need somebody else to step up and go and sit alongside Verstappen, who's obviously a generational talent. As you say, he came at this in a slightly different way. It was an opportunistic move from Helmut Marko.
I call him the test tube baby. You know, he was, you know, if you know your karting mum, Sophie was amazing. Dad, Jos.
Yeah. Well, she used to beat Horner and Fisichella.
Yeah, she was very good. I remember watching her in my own karting in the time. She was very, very good. Raymond, the manager, the whole process was engineered to deliver a race driver. Very, very well done. You know, Jos was tuning the kart engines all the way through. So different scenario. They got a kind of a whole business almost, or a kind of company ready to deliver a driver. These other guys we're talking about, you know, the Jevs, the Daniels, the Danny Kvyats, those guys haven't got that whole backlog of resource and people behind them. So the Red Bull system picked them up and made it happen for them. Carlos is, again, kind of in between. Carlos, the dad senior, was working very well with Red Bull already. So there was a natural kind of business already kind of working behind Carlos. And Max, you know, was going to be delivered one way or the other, whether it was in a Mercedes or a Red Bull, he was going to get there. You know, the whole thing was built to do it. So they're slightly different. And I kind of enjoyed seeing all of those different characters. I enjoyed Max coming in, but Max came in full of confidence because he's had this big kind of juggernaut of resource. I say juggernaut, you know, it's a few guys and girls, but good group of people kind of delivering him. Whereas Danny Kvyat or Jev or Daniel were almost taking themselves out of home, out of their comfort zone, moving to Italy to go karting or moving to Europe to race or being involved in new teams with the Red Bull backing. It's a slightly different scenario. So you saw the situation that those young drivers were in. And also, if you take Max and Carlos, the fathers were a big part of that and they were at the track. Daniel, Jev, Daniel, those guys haven't got that same help with them. So different situation. And that was also interesting for me to see. Really interesting.
So you've played such an instrumental role in watching the development and being part of the development of Daniel Ricciardo as a driver. And then you look and, you know, he's now in his early 30s, but he's out basically for the second time. And he should be in his peak years. So looking at it from the outside, and I appreciate as an engineer, you always want to have proper data before you make any decisions. But what's your feeling about what went wrong?
It's really difficult. Like you say, as an engineer, you want to see all the detail. And when you stand outside of an engineering group trying to look in, it's also quite tricky to see what's right, what's wrong. As you've kind of seen over the years, some drivers suit certain tyre. They suit a certain aerodynamic regulation setup that helps them to drive a car in a certain way. So he can be a little bit of a victim of just the way the cars have evolved, the way the tyres have evolved. That's very easy to happen, and we've seen that a number of times. But what I can say about Daniel, you know, you kind of rewind back a couple of minutes now and we talk about him building the people around him. In the Red Bull world, he came through that and he collected his people up as he went. You know, he collected his lovers of him, you know, his kind of invested parties. And you can see that as he goes through to other teams, you've got to start again each time. So he was never just about natural talent. He was about that package outside of the car. That's all got to fit. That can be impacted by the other driver as well. Don't forget, you know, we've seen many examples of a change of driver in the other seat, and that can impact the first driver a huge amount. If the team, the environment around the team has a slightly different focus or a different ambience or a different kind of feeling for what's happening. People don't intend in Formula One nowadays to bias one car. It makes no sense now. You've got enough parts. You've got enough resource. It's not about giving one driver a big advantage. But if you do build a character in the team or build around a character in the team, it can impact the other one. So it's very possible, knowing Daniel from those early years, you know, I haven't followed him through all those years, I haven't spoken to him for years, actually. But knowing him in those early years, you can see how the character, how the environment around him is really, really important. I can also see that as he's progressed through his career, that could be impacted a little bit as well. So that would be my guess. My guess is great driver, possibly been impacted a little bit by the regulations and the way of driving these cars, but more likely it's the fit, it's the environment.
The environment.
Yeah. And maybe a little bit of his own motivation. You know, does he still have the same hunger he did when I knew him in 2012, 2013? I don't know. That's the bit I can't tell you from the outside, but that was his big secret. It was his intelligence, his desire. These guys were pushing to get to that next thing. That's hard to keep that level up as well. I don't know whether that's a part of what happened in the later years.
It's fascinating, Phil. Absolutely fascinating. I mean, the cycle of a driver, you know, the development phase, especially in an environment like Red Bull, and reminding us that at the end of the day, for all that it's about machinery, this is an intensely human sport, and often the reasons why things go wrong are just human reasons.
It's
not
a squishy bit.
It's
a squishy bit. We talk about it a lot. You can find whatever it might be, a few thousandth in your latest bit of code or setup or whatever it might be. But if that driver's had a bad day the day before, or he's had a cold, or he's something's upset him, you can lose a lot more than that. And so their head game is massive, massive, massive. And that's the bit I can't advise you on. I can give you a bit of view of how he was back in those days. And I can tell you he was very sensitive to the environment, to the people. That was a big advantage for him, was using those guys. I can't tell you the recent years, how that's been for him.
And finally, briefly, obviously you work with, still, you mentioned earlier on, you're still working with Jean-Éric Vergne, because you're now deputy team principal of DS Penske in Formula E. And we're sitting in your office here with a Formula E powertrain between us on the desk, which is, first of all, remarkably small in comparison to a Formula One engine, given the amount of power it's generating. But are you enjoying this world?
Absolutely. So I was explaining to you a little bit earlier, I never went back to F1. I got hooked with the powertrain tech that we've got here. I'm an engineer through and through. I'm a deputy team principal now, and that means I organise people. I make sure we've got a good, great group of people, and it's a smaller scenario. So it's fun to do that. It's like a family we were talking about earlier. I really enjoy that. But I enjoyed F1. I enjoyed the kind of magnitude of what you can do there, how quickly you can move parts, how quickly you can develop a car. I do miss bits of that, but I really love the powertrain. I love the race weekend in Formula E. You know, it happens all on one day. If it's a double header, two races, two qualifyings in 2 days, it's absolutely crazy. And the racing is very different, you know, very strategic, very short races that you almost can't blink in. They're kind of so action-packed. So yeah, no, I've been really enjoying it. I love my F1 time, had great years in F1, but also loving Formula E as well.
Fantastic. Well, it's lovely to see you. Thank you for making the time for us.
No, thank you so much, James.
So let's start with what made Ricciardo special as a race driver. And it sounds like it's his ability to get the most from the people around him, the kind of human quality, if you like, motivating the team with a smile that Phil considered his superpower, Ben.
Yeah, absolutely. And you talk to anyone that's worked with Daniel, and the majority of them are gushing about just his personality and how he's able to lift all the spirits within the team. Christian Horner always used to say that Daniel was his favourite Formula One driver, and I assume it's just because of that personality and the lift that he would give everyone. Even when things were going, you know, against the grain, he would be able to, you know, salvage the situation and brighten the mood. You know, obviously there's the tenacity and the ability behind the wheel, the refusal to give in, which we've already spoken about, but there's so many factors, but most of them are the personal one. He's a very personable person. And I think that's what most people remember about working with Daniel.
John, it's interesting as well, because Phil's a very, very experienced engineer. And it's interesting that he highlighted the precision and the kind of evolution of the planning, you know, the intelligence with which Ricciardo went racing. And everything was meticulously planned. And he would like discuss how this corner he was going to break a few meters later in qualifying, and this corner. It was all, you know, very, very detailed and what have you, which he says also explains the background to those mega overtakes that we've seen from Ricciardo, the sort of sticker stamp on it and send it, as he calls it, you know, where he just could be sure that he would be able to slow the car down into the corner to make the overtake stick. I found that really interesting.
Yeah, I think there's often this kind of almost myth from outside that, you know, drivers just jump in the car and then the natural talent does the job for them and then they get out and that's the end of the job. And I think, you know, for some drivers, you know, maybe that is true, that it's, you know, all just down to natural talent. They go out there and don't need to do these extra things. And then on the flip side, we get some drivers. I mean, Fernando Alonso is brilliant at this, about talking about the extra details and levels he's done in the past to find that edge. I remember I sat down with him once. I was in the Red Bull Ring. It was a sprint race, and I was sat in the media center and looking at the start finish track. There's one car was going off the racing line onto the dirty side of the track consistently when the practice was in the morning for the sprint race. And I looked over, and it was Fernando Alonso cleaning his side of the grid where he would start his car from. No one else was doing it. It's something Piastri, I noticed, did it last year in Qatar, I think. So there's these kind of extra elements they do. And I thought it was interesting him talking about Daniel going off racing line, for example, in practice, just to see where the elements were. But Daniel's not the sort of guy who would come out and say, look how brilliant I was, I did this, and this is all the practice. I think all the personality kind of won him over for the kind of the perception of his talents and his brilliance. And I think it's also endeared him with the team, which allowed him to work on this. But I think there was an extra element of kind of workload and ethic and determination and digging a bit deeper that, you know, prevailed throughout his whole career.
Well, he joined Red Bull Racing in 2014 and actually beat Sebastian Vettel in that first season. So Vettel was coming off the back of four straight world championships. There was a rule change, of course, the introduction of the hybrid turbos and the removal of some aerodynamic things, which obviously Vettel had very much enjoyed in those dominant Red Bull years. But whatever it was, a lot of people were surprised that Ricciardo was able to just step straight in and beat Vettel, but it didn't surprise Phil, as he was very clearly pointing out there. And he says it's because Daniel was ready for the people, and he did the people bit really, really well, which I guess when you think about it, Ben, is also perhaps maybe why other people who got the promotion, like Alex Albon or Pierre Gasly or Danny Kvyat, you know, do you think that's where they went wrong?
Possibly. I think it's perhaps his ability, if we flip it around, his ability to stand out. I think that's probably what set him apart. We've obviously spoken about his driving ability, but it is that personality which marked him different from everyone else. You know, a fiercely competitive racer, you know, a fairly good junior campaign. I was, when we were talking, you know, about this podcast, and I was trying to think back to my first memory of Daniel, and I remember joining F1 in 2012, and he was on the plane to Malaysia, and he was sat in economy, and I remember him coming on like really smiley, and lots of people have spotted him. And, you know, it was kind of, he was kind of in with everyone else. And I really liked that. You know, he wasn't kicking off that he was at the front of the plane or anything like that. You know, he was sat there. And I don't know, I just had him down from that moment onwards as someone that was very real. And I think that that quality is what kept him in Formula One for so long, and obviously making him so likable. You know, a great, great record, you know, ability to turn it on his day. A few poor career decisions, shall we say, in terms of picking which team to go to. But as I mentioned before, it is such a shame that he's off the grid from this point onwards.
It's great. I love stories like that. I once flew in economy all the way to Japan sitting next to Eddie Irvine when he was driving for Jordan. It's like, it's the kind of thing that doesn't really happen so much these days. But it's great to see. I mean, so much of being successful in this is the structure that you build around yourself as a Grand Prix driver. And, you know, sometimes you've only got 1 year to prove yourself or such a short amount of time. And you've got to remember, these guys are so young as well. I mean, Fern was younger than Ricardo, which I think was a big part of why he didn't get. I think he was only about 19 at the time. It's just so hard when you're that young to be so smart that you've got to put the system around you. Nevertheless, it was really interesting to get a window into that whole Red Bull driver development process. I mean, it's a system that so far produced 7 drivers' world titles, maybe an 8th in a couple of months' time for Verstappen, but it's also binned a lot of talented drivers, as we well know. At times, the pipeline has also dried up. And at the moment, you know, there's a bit of a question mark about, you know, if they had the right person to be replacing Perez, they would be in the car right now, wouldn't they? John, how do you think that whole process of Red Bulls at developing drivers compares with the process of like Mercedes, Ferrari, McLaren, Alpine, the others, et cetera?
I think an awful lot depends on the kind of you've got two parallel things happening. You've got where your the junior drivers you brought in, how are they performing at the top? And then you go for Red Bull, you look at Max, you can look at someone like Ricardo, Albon, etc. You know, if they hit the peaks, then you're not under pressure to bring people up below them. If, however, for example, they don't get on with the car, or they don't get on with the tyres, or competitiveness isn't as good for Red Bull or the second Red Bull seat as hoped, then the churn happens quicker, and then the pressure's on to bring more people up. So you're always kind of juggling these two things, and you hope as a team and your timeline that when you need to find a replacement, that someone has hit the peaks and is ready to slot in. I mean, Toto Wolff, you know, incredibly good fortune in some respects that Lewis has moved and opened up that second seat for next year. If it had come a year sooner, no chance to bring Antonelli in a year earlier. So sometimes it's, you know, pure good fortune and circumstance outside your control. Sometimes you're left in a hole, as Red Bull found himself in, and needed to bring Sergio Perez across. You can argue it has worked to some extent because they got the Constructors' Championship, finished 1-2 in the Championship last year. It's not working so well this year. But what is interesting, I think, now is this: the fashion's gone back to rookie drivers. We've seen with Behrmann, with Colapinto, Antonelli, for example, and we've got Doohan coming in, that there seems more faith now that the rookies can come in and do a great job. And I think this is ultimately what's forced Red Bull's hand to move Daniel Ricciardo. And they need to see what Lawson can do. Then you see if he's capable of stepping up to that Red Bull seat. Unfortunately, I think Yuki Tsunoda's, you know, never going to get his hands on a Red Bull cockpit. I don't think the team believe he's got the right kind of personality or mindset and lots of other elements that they'd like to see from him. So they're looking at Lawson, and if Lawson doesn't step up this season, then it, you know, may take the pressure off Perez. If Lawson's a star, you know, blows Yuki out of the water, then, you know, maybe Red Bull will roll the dice and slot him in at the top end next year, and then be able to bring up one of their other youngsters coming through the system.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you've got the dynamic of having two teams. You've got to fill those seats, haven't you? It's kind of a problem on some side. Other times they've got too many drivers and they need to create the space. So, you know, they are running two teams, and that's what's been the success for a lot of these drivers that come through. They've had the ability to cut their teeth at the sister team, like Daniel, like Sebastian, you know, able to make the mistakes in the low profile team, and then obviously make that transition. So it's kind of a luxurious position to be in, unlike any other team on the grid.
Yeah, it's a good point. And to your point about the rookie drivers, John, actually, we've had a question from one of the listeners, which we'll get to before we sign off at the end, which is on that very topic. But let's turn our attention now to what went wrong for Ricciardo. He clearly lost his way when he left Red Bull for Renault, although he had a pretty strong season in 2020. I think he finished fifth in the championship that year. That was the kind of behind closed doors pandemic season. But he'd already sort of decided he was going to McLaren by then. He won that race in Monza, which was spectacular, but sort of lost his way. Interesting to hear Phil's view on why, from the outside, on why he thinks that was, which again comes down to that ability to sort of feel in the right place with the people around him and create that environment, which perhaps he wasn't able to do at those teams. But I wonder what conclusions you've both come to about why he could never hit the heights again after he left Red Bull.
I think some of it comes down to, you know, the machinery and the infrastructure around you. And there's some elements, you know, some people can thrive in one environment and get suffocated, you know, if people change or systems change or different people running it. And I think Formula One these days, the margins have got so tight and the kind of performance differences between the cars are so small that every single little detail needs to line up. And Daniel perhaps not being, you know, as comfortable perhaps with the ground effect cars, could have been a bit of a factor in what happened. Perhaps changes to the tyre characteristics. We look at Lewis Hamilton, for example, his qualifying struggles. A lot of that, I'm told, is just down to him not having that confidence and ability and strength that you used to have in the tyres and be able to brake 5 metres later or 6 metres later or 7 metres later in qualifying. Mm-hmm. That is not there with these tyres. And we know Daniel was so strong on the brakes. It was one of the hallmarks of his performances. So, you know, are there parallels to be drawn between Lewis's qualifying struggles and Daniel not making it in Formula One? Perhaps. I think there's endless factors. And these are the sort of things you can't predict. There are reasons why Daniel left Red Bull, you know, perhaps feeling that, you know, the mood of the team, the focus of the team was shifting more towards Max and it wasn't going to be a place he could win the world championship. So you make your decisions. I thought it was just quite interesting when he posted his little Instagram post on the day it was confirmed he was leaving. He said, you know, no regrets. We'll do it all the same way again, which I thought was a very kind of honest assessment of where things are.
Yes, I'm not so sure.
Maybe from a financial point of view, but yes, I'm not sure from a racing point of view. I think the big thing at the heart of that, though, is do you really honestly, in your heart of heart, believe you're going to be a world champion? You know, if you do, you've got to get away from Verstappen and try and plow your own furrow and find a championship winning car. But if you want to be successful at top level, and anything can happen, I mean, it's such a difficult decision, isn't it, Ben? What conclusions have you come to?
Well, I think it all kind of midway through 2019, that season with Max, he finished the championship in ninth. And I think that for me is one of the definitive points. You know, he had a handshake with Helmut Marko and Dietrich Mateschitz, and there were some interesting quotes that came out from Marko in the wake of Daniel's removal from Red Bull. And he said, you know, that was kind of for him the moment where he was toast. He, you know, that he had agreed to do a deal for the following year and then decided to join Renault instead. And, you know, I don't think any of us could quite have believed, you know, at the time when he was joining Renault, because there was so much animosity between Red Bull and Renault at the time. And of course he made that switch, and you know, that season, the Red Bull season, he finished sixth, and then obviously into Renault he's ninth. And you know, it kind of, that's the moment when things start to go wrong for him. You know, whether he's overdriving, trying too hard, you know, and things just didn't work out at Renault, and then made that switch to McLaren. And you know, that's kind of been, that period has been over dramatized. I think I'm going to talk about Drive to Survive for a second time, but I think that it was a little bit, it wasn't the same way as it was presented in that show. I think that there was there's a lot more harmony between him and Lando than was made out to be. But yeah, he just wasn't able to regain that form. And then, you know, the other moment was when he decided, there were teams obviously interested in him, but once he had been released by McLaren, he decided upon himself that he wanted to take time out. And I think that the moment you do that, then you're never going to come back as strong as you were. You've already decided that you just want a little bit of time on the sidelines. And Whether he ever fully regained his passion for Formula One, I don't know. But, you know, he certainly gave us the impression that he did want to stay. And you can see now that he's very dejected. Now it's over. But unfortunately, it wasn't his decision anymore. You know, this was made above his head. So, you know, quite unfortunate that he was in that position. But, yeah, those two moments, I think, turning down Red Bull and deciding to go to Renault, and then obviously taking that time out deliberately so to find out if he still liked F1, they were two telltale signs for me.
Yeah, maybe. So, well, so much for Ricciardo, the racing driver. You've referenced there, Ben, the drive survivor. I mean, it showed that Ricciardo had undoubted star power, certainly far more than people perhaps realised before that show bounced into the scene in Formula One. And the entertainment factor was a huge part of his appeal to fans and made him very valuable to Formula One. Now, one man who's known Daniel from his early days is Australian F1 TV host Greg Rust. I worked with Rusty for several years on Network 10, the host broadcaster in Australia, and he offered this perspective on his fellow countrymen. Well, Rusty, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's great to see you again. I mean, tell me about the Daniel Ricciardo that you know.
Probably one of the coolest memories that I have, James, and it's lovely to catch up with you, is actually going to visit his parents, Joe and Grace, at their house in Perth when this journey was about to begin for him, before the HRT news and before he would ultimately move into to Toro Rosso, and to having a beautiful conversation with his mum around, I guess, the emotion of her son going to live overseas and what that would mean, and this bright, smiley kid being so excited about a potential path to, you know, the sport that he's loved since he was so young. And his dad, as you know, is such a passionate lover of anything two and four wheels, has been a racer himself. So, yeah, to see him, having worked with Mark Webber in the Network 10 era, to see this new young fella coming on board, it was a nice kind of baton change in some respects. And, I know that the career may not have been fulfilled in terms of that F1 World Championship that many of us thought was possible, but some wins at legendary places and driving for some great teams. For me, there's a lot of very cool things to walk away from a part of the world that, as you know, is very difficult for us to break into Formula One traditionally.
We hear all the time, Rusty, that Daniel was very important for the image of Formula One. You know, part of why Christian Horner kept him in the fold was because, you know, Drive to Survive loved him. The audiences loved him. When we did a global fan survey back in 2021, he came out top among certain demographics and age groups and what have you. But how is Ricciardo viewed by Australian fans and audiences?
I think much loved in the manner that you've spoken about, because of his likable personality. Some of the crazy stuff, you know, riding a horse into the paddock in Texas, and people just seem to, even though they didn't completely know him, seem to realize that was the real Daniel Ricciardo, and they warmed to that. So the kind of surveys and results that you speak of aren't surprising at all. It's little wonder that I think he was one of the first ever interviews on Drive to Survive. Little wonder that his character from there kind of shot to stardom, plus the success that he enjoyed around the edges. So Australia is such a tough country, James. You see our athletes in all sorts of sports, and if you don't quite make the cut for whatever reason, we seem to be these brutal people. I try and be glass half full about it and look at what he was able to do. That Red Bull system is such a tough system to get through, to get selected in the first place, and to think that he made it through that, had a great career with them, and kind of bookended, came back to the family a little bit at the end. And I think we should be celebrating more of that, to be honest.
It's interesting because when you look back on his career, you do think of him as the kind of smiley guy, you know, the charismatic guy, the joker. Bernie Eccleston always used to say that Formula One is literally like a circus and you need to figure out what act you are. And, you know, I think critics of Daniel would say that he allowed himself perhaps to be a clown more than a serious racing driver. You and I obviously work with him a lot on Australian TV. We know the very serious racing driver that Daniel was underneath. And that sort of steeliness that he had, which he showed on the racetrack a number of times, particularly in the races that he won. But do you think he did allow himself to just become perhaps a little bit too much of a goofball?
No, I don't. I think that's the reason why he was the honey badger beneath all of that, true character that enabled him to enjoy what we were talking about, leaving his parents and doing all that stuff away from home to, you know, not be so super serious about it out of the cockpit, I think was really important to then what he delivered behind the wheel. I don't think it got to, in my opinion anyway, I don't think it got to a point where that stuff overtook the driving. That's not how he's wired.
What do you think went wrong for him then?
That's a good question. I'm not a believer in life that you make wrong decisions. That's probably a silly thing to say, but you make the best decision you can at the time. There's probably a strong argument for should he have ever have left the Red Bull fold. People invariably grow when they make big calls like that, and I still think that he grew, but unfortunately some of those moves were not great cars or not great teams and situations. Admittedly, that win at Monza for McLaren is still incredibly memorable for me. Coming up against Max Verstappen would have been hugely difficult if he'd stayed in the Red Bull fold. But, you know, arguably, I think there would have been more wins to his name had he stayed, James. So it's a game, as you know better than anybody, that is all about timing and the moves that you make in your career. And at the beginning, absolutely in the right place. But then I guess you could question some of the latter ones. And it's just a shame that it didn't sort of ultimately end with a complete return to the mothership and actually finishing his days at Red Bull.
Well, when you talk about serious racing drivers, you've got another one that's coming through the system now and has already won a couple of races in only his second year, Oscar Piastri, another Australian, very, very serious individual. I mean, how do you see the contrast between the two?
He reminds me so often of Mark Webber in his mannerisms and his work ethic and the way that he goes about it. I sense we are just starting to realise how special this kid is. I mean, he's not a kid anymore, but he's just so incredibly disciplined, enormously fast. I think we are yet to see the best, but we've seen a glimpse of it. So I think it's from an Australian perspective, we've got a lot to, in the one hand, while we're kind of going to miss Daniel, we're excited about the fact that he's doing great things and has even more to come and what Jack Doohan might do. And then separately, as you know, I spend a lot of time in New Zealand nowadays and the wave of excitement about young Liam Lawson over there and that he's finally going to get that break that he's waited so patiently for and showed all the right things last year when he subbed for Daniel. That is for me in the whole bittersweet thing with Dan here, he deserves this moment, Liam. He deserves this chance and I couldn't be more excited for him.
What's your favourite Ricciardo moment?
Horse off track going into the paddock. I reckon that's awesome. Arguably, too, the fall into the pool at Monaco. To think that he won at a legendary place like Monaco is a huge thing. But just knowing a little, I can't profess to know them closely, James, but a little of the family and those early, you know, that time I spent with them in the early days, and I realised what great people they were. To think that this young man has been able to come from karting and a little bit of experience in Australia and then fundamentally roll the dice and go to Europe and to make a career out of it, to make it to Formula One, more should probably be appreciated of that down under here.
Well, I'm sure he won't want for offers, Rusty. I see that the boss of Aussie Supercars has already suggested he should go and do Bathurst and race with them, which would certainly put a few on the gate. Very popular series down under. Of course, he's a big NASCAR fan. You could do guest appearances there. There's always Le Mans. There's a lot of things. What's your gut instinct tell you that will be the next step for Dan Ricciardo?
I think he'll have probably a little breather to catch, you know, get a bit of perspective on what's happened here. The supercars thing intrigues me. He has driven one, of course, in a promotional capacity, and probably compared to Mark Webber, who didn't really warm to that idea. He just had it framed right, Mark. He didn't think he thought there was more to lose by doing that than to gain, because they're such a unique beast, such a unique race car. Daniel might entertain that idea. I hope he's not lost to Formula One, James. It will take a little while to get his head around being involved in another capacity. I don't know what that is. I know, for example, in that little period there before he came back to the sport, he did some commentary with the comedian Will Arnett from the Smartless podcast and so on. You know, maybe something like that, if he's involved in the sport in some way in the paddock. And if he could get his head around that in time, it'd be very hard to stop. That's why I think he spent so long in Singapore there in the cockpit the other night, because to stop doing that is a very, very difficult thing when it's been your life for so long.
Rusty, it's great to catch up with you. Thank you so much for your insights. Take care of yourself.
Cheers, James. Thank you.
I mean, Rusty's right, isn't he? Who else but Daniel Ricciardo would have ridden a horse into the F1 paddock? F1 is a cynical world, but my question is, did it work for him or not?
That moment I really struggled with, because that to me gave me the impression that he had totally tuned out from Formula One and that this was the end. I didn't see him coming back, actually. Once he did that horse stunt, as funny as it was, this was a guy that had been shown the door by McLaren and was just sort of turning everything down. I was like, no, I'm just going to spend some time, wait for the right opportunity, etc. But as I say, for me, that was the moment that he had kind of turned his back on Formula One, and I thought, we're never going to see him in a car again. So I was quite surprised that he did come back, actually. But yeah, good PR stunt, or was it, shall we say?
What do you reckon, John? Do you think it worked for him or not? Do you think it was counterproductive?
No, but I think this is what endeared Daniel to the fans, and I think it's what endeared him to the people he worked with. So it was an important makeup of kind of his personality and his core strengths was, you know, he's one of those people that played hard and worked hard, in effect, that didn't take himself too seriously, could, you know, get everyone on his side through this kind of beaming, smiling personality, didn't seem to have the kind of the strops and the downsides that we hear some current drivers who take themselves far too seriously have. So I think it worked. And ultimately, if you ride a horse into the paddock, there's not going to make you one tenth slower. it's all about the job on the track. And I think he balanced out those two things quite well in the end. And I think when you look at it quite brutally, getting people on side, even the media, for example, is really, really important. Because I think if some other drivers had had the kind of the downs that he's had this season in terms of performances and inconsistency, people would be on the back going, why are you keeping him in this car? You've got this superstar, you know, Liam Lawson on the sideline. He should be in there straight away. So sometimes these things do matter. And, you know, being friendly and smiley and happy and personable can be really, really important and can have kind of knock-on benefits for the job in hand of keeping your hands in a Formula One cockpit.
Yeah, that's true. You know, we saw that earlier in Canada, didn't we, when Jacques Villeneuve was quite outspoken. He said, you know, I see Daniel and think, what are you doing here? And that was his opinion. But there was people quite split on that. I remember him taking a bit of heat from people saying that he shouldn't have and share such opinions. So quite interesting.
Well, he had a moment or two of his own like that towards the end of his career. But so there you go. So he coined the term for himself as the honey badger, which looks cute and cuddly, but is actually a real killer. And I think that's how Daniel Ricciardo would like us to remember him as a Grand Prix driver. So we'll round it up there. But before we go, we have had a number of messages and questions. Thank you for those. Please keep them coming. There's one that I think is relevant to what we've been chatting about today, which comes from Luke Earthcrawler on X, who says, it seems to me that Formula One is reaping the benefits of having F2 and F3 on F1 TV. To me, it seems like we have more championship talent coming through the pipeline now than we did in the last 30 years. I think he's referencing the fact, you mentioned it earlier in the chat, John, and that we've got obviously Behrman, Colapinto's done a good job coming in this year. Antonelli next year, Behrman and Doohan are all joining the grid. It's a bit one of those cycles because Piastri has shown how strong the rookies can be. It's kind of created a bit of a trend and a vogue. I'm interested in both your views on this. I think the two-year-old car testing is also an important part of it. And we have to also point out that these people are not winning the F2 championship. They're guys who are sort of making the jump across. But how do you two read this?
I think preparation is probably the key explanation here. When you go back to, you know, when Lewis Hamilton came in as a rookie, you know, tens of thousands of kilometers of testing all that winter, was really, really well prepared. When Jacques Villeneuve came in, same story. Then we had this period where testing's banned. F1 simulators weren't particularly, you know, super sophisticated as they are these days. So it's a period where perhaps the rookies weren't as prepared and invested in everything and you couldn't test old cars. Whereas now I think what the Piastri situation where he was doing all those tests for Alpine in an old car showed the value that that can happen. So you kind of need this 1 year build up. And I think this is what's making the difference now, is that these guys are on really top level simulators now, learning, you know, what's needed for controls, for driving characteristics, for tires, different track surfaces, grips, setups, everything. So that they've got this background of preparation that rookies 5-10 years ago perhaps didn't have. They get mileage in 2 year old cars, and you're thrown into, I think also this era potentially is helping a little bit, because Fernando Alonso talked about this in Singapore, that, you know, these cars don't like being driven 100% on the edge all the time. Actually, you're quicker driving them at 90%. And actually, that's quite good for people coming in, because you've got this little bit of a comfort window to extract the performance. So it's not like you're being thrown in and having to drive really difficult cars flat out every single lap on a Sunday to come out. There's many more elements to it. So I think it's a culmination of all these things just coming together. And it takes one, you know, I think Piastri and Behrmann coming and doing what they're doing has suddenly made the rookies fashionable again.
I agree. Simwork systems and staff is what I put down on my notepad. I think that these young guys are so integrated now into teams that they're so familiar with the operation side of things and also the staff. It's kind of, you know, you go into a Formula One team and they already know everything, and they know everything about the young driver as well, and they're able to get the best out of each other. So I think that they complement each other well, and, you know, that's really good for Formula One. I think the point about seeing progression, I think, seeing the lower formula, is that we can now see progression and we're able to, you know, appreciate some of the talents. I think it's great that we are actually watching the lower formula races, because they are obviously stars of the future. But yeah, I mean, the whole rookies coming in and doing so well, it is great to see. After no changes last year, it's going to be quite exciting next year just to see how well these guys do. And obviously under huge pressure to deliver. It's going to be really fun.
I couldn't agree more. That's a great place to end then. Please do send us your questions or comments to @JamesAllenOnF1 on X/Twitter, or email JamesAllenOnF1@autosport.com. My thanks to Phil Charles, to Greg Rust, John Noble and Ben Hunt. You can read all John and Ben's insightful F1 stories on Autosport Online or via the app. Please do make sure to check out all the behind-the-scenes F1 stuff on the Autosport podcast. My thanks to Dre, Matt and Jason on production, and thanks to you all for listening. Please click to follow or subscribe, leave us a review and a rating, and tell all your F1 mad friends about us. We love seeing new listeners discovering the podcast, and we'll be back with another one very soon.